Hi, this is David Wilk for Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. And today I'm interviewing Tim O'Reilly, who heads the eponymous O'Reilly Books. How are you, Tim?
Hi, I'm fine.
Good. Well, thanks for being with me today. I figure you're fairly busy, so I'm going to try to be, somewhat efficient as I talk to you. But could you just talk a little bit about, very briefly, maybe give the history of your involvement in publishing, how you got into it, and how your work has evolved over the years?
Yeah, I started my company way back in the late 70s with a partner as a tech writing consulting company. And we broke up the partnership in 83, and I sort of restarted the company. It was called O'Reilly & Associates originally. But we soon figured out that many of the topics, the computer book topics that people cared about, the manuals that we were being hired to write, everybody wanted the same thing. So we started retaining the rights. And then in 1985, we started publishing them as books. That quickly became our principal business. But we got into the publishing business really by the back door. We didn't know anything about it. Our very first books were little pamphlets that were stapled. We didn't have ISBNs because we'd never heard of them. We sold direct to consumers and we sold to corporations. And we were about $7 million a year in revenue before we got into bookstores at all. And so because of that focus on the actual consumer of the product, as opposed to, things that would work in the channel, we, always had a very, very different focus than most publishers. And everything from pricing to form factors to design. And we end up revolutionizing computer book publishing and went on over the next, 25 years now plus, to become the largest computer book publisher in the country. We accomplished that with our recent deal with Microsoft Press, where we're taking over a chunk of their publishing and also distributing their books to bookstores.
And, of course, you've been involved in the web for a very long time.
Yes, absolutely. So in the early, it was actually in the late 80s, we really began experimenting with online publishing. It's a long story why we were doing it, but we were early believer that eventually, publishing would need to move online. And we, in the course of that discovery process, we were one of the first early adopters of the World Wide Web. So we actually launched the very first commercial website, but there are only about 200 websites in total. We had one that was advertising supported. So I am the person who brought first brought advertising to the web. And it was in March of 1993. And we created the first web portal, which we later sold to AOL.
Yeah, I actually remember that because I was involved, pretty early on as a consumer on the web, or as trying to use it for business purposes. And I remember actually being on that site at one point.
Yeah, GNN, the Global Network Navigator.
Right, but dial-up, of course.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
And
then we went from there to just continuing to focus on how would we build, sort of an e-book ecosystem over time. And we continued to experiment. In the late 90s, we offered a product called CD Bookshelves, where we would bundle a book with a CD that contained another sort of six or seven books, in electronic form, so that we could use the distribution channel to sort of bootstrap an appetite for reading online. And then in 2000, we launched a service called Safari Books Online, which is a subscription service. And to do that, we actually got together with our biggest competitor, Pearson Technology Group, which one of the other largest computer book publishers in the country. They're an amalgamation of many, many brands. They're familiar, Addison Wesley, Peachbit, Sam's, and the like. And we realized that if we got together with them, we could build a compelling offering that would be, a great subscription offering. Safari has grown tremendously since then. It's now actually, for O'Reilly, our second biggest channel after Amazon.com. We get more revenue from Safari than we get from Barnes & Noble, for example.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Safari, because I think that is something that is really interesting and useful for other publishers and potentially consumers to be aware of, and that is your sales model there is very different than what traditional publishers have ever done.
Well, you know, I have to say, we are in a niche, and not all of the lessons apply. You know, people who consume computer books are, you know, they're heavy consumers of information. When they need something, they need it now. And, you know, we reasoned that this would make it a compelling offering to give people access to everything as opposed to access to one book at a time. And that's not true in every niche. So, for example, if you think about, say, travel, you're a heavy consumer of a few books every once in a while.
Right. It actually may even atomize more. You may only go to one place, and you only need the information
about
that right. one place.
That's right. So, you know, subscription doesn't make sense there. On the other hand, you know, there's a category like romance, which you would think of as as far away from computer books as possible, and yet the subscription model probably works quite well there because
right.
the typical reader, you know, consumes a lot of books.
Right, it would work for mystery, I would think, it's science
That's
fiction.
Right, certain kinds of genre subscription services where you could say, oh, yeah, we have, you know, an audience that wants a lot of this and would find a compelling model here in saying, wow, it's actually cheaper to subscribe than it is to, you know, to buy books one at a time.
Right. Although
that being said, I mean, you know, I've always been a big believer in the beauty of publishing is that lots and lots of economic models coexist. It's not one choice. You know, I remember explaining this in the early days of the web to Ted Leonsis at AOL, and he had this great line, because I was saying, you know, what's wrong with the web is there aren't enough business models. And he said, oh, I get it. You're saying, where is the publisher's clearinghouse for the web? You know, you think about that. You know, there's companies in publishing for magazines or books, you know, publisher's clearinghouse. They run contests to give away magazine subscriptions. You know, it's sort of like, you know, there's companies that, like Scholastic, that run, you know, whole programs in schools where the schools support it because they get part of the take. You know, there was all these oddball kinds of niches, and I think that, you know, what has been happening online in the last, you know, two decades has been the development of that robust, rich ecosystem of economic niches. And I think, you know, the e-book revolution is really coming along nicely now because there are alternatives. You do have the subscription models. You do have the direct downloads of titles. You have multiple devices. You have the Kindle. You have the iPhone. You know, and other smartphones. You have a whole slew of other e-readers, you know, coming on stream. Now, what we as publishers need to think about, first of all, is what do the readers want? And you know, the readers, first of all, they want convenience. They want portability. That is, they don't want to be locked into one device. You know, suppose you break your Kindle and you have to, oh my gosh, I have to buy another one.
Or if you just want to move, you know, if you
You want to move to another device and you go,
right.
oh, I have to buy everything all over again?
Right.
Again,
or
Amazon's
you,
made some moves in the right direction with the Kindle app for iPhone, for example, or being able to read on the PC.
Right, exactly. Essentially
but,
buy it and be able to read it anywhere.
Yeah, but our goal, you know, from the very beginning, this really goes back to our first experiments with electronic publishing in the 80s. We were a lot of our technical books were adopted by, you know, computer workstation vendors who were all, you know, looking to make their mark with their distinctive system. You know, there were these competing documentation systems. They said, oh, well, you put your books into our system. And we said, oh, we don't want to have our books in 30 different formats. We're going to create one format, and you guys all learn to read it. And that was the origin of an XML. Well, eventually became an XML format called DocBook for technical documentation. And, you know, we've focused ever since then on industry standard formats for books. And that's why we're, in our own ebook advocacy, we're pushing EPUB, which is the closest thing we have to a standard, and why when we offer books for download from O'Reilly.com, we actually offer people a bundle of all the formats. You know, you have your choice of downloading a PDF a Mobi file, which you can load onto a Kindle, an EPUB file, which works on the iPhone or the Sony Reader or the Nook, or now, just recently, a PRK file, which works on an Android phone. Now, we figure, you know, part of what makes it easy for us to do that is that we built an XML publishing tool chain that makes it pretty trivial for us to output another format. You know, so, and that was actually a part of what led to our deal with Microsoft Press. They're really interested in participating in this ebook revolution, and you know, we had this tool chain that would made it easy for them to get their books out in multiple formats.
And do you, would you? I mean, just as an aside, for publishers who are thinking about you know, who have not been doing this for as long as you have, and there are many, many publishers who have kind of waited to see how things evolve before they make decisions about entering the e-publishing ecosystem. If you were advising publishers, and I'm not necessarily talking about the biggest publishers, but just say the thousands of publishers who are smaller and who may not have vast resources, I mean, you know, do you recommend to them that it's now time for them to begin to learn how things work in a digital workflow, and what do they need to do?
Well, first off, it is absolutely time. Early in the market is when the barriers to entry are lowest and where a small player can have the biggest impact if they're creative, if they're exploring the potential of the market. Once it's much more developed, you know, there's a lot of players already there, and you know, you're not the first and only choice. Small companies, you know, tend to dominate in new markets because it's easy to get visibility. You know, once you've got, you know, just even look now at the iPhone. Once you have 100,000 iPhone apps, it's a lot harder to rise to the top than it was a year ago. So, you know, ebooks are, you know, on fire right now, and any publisher that's not thinking about them and sitting on the sidelines is basically saying, I'm going to let other people dominate my market. So a good example of that is, say, birding guides. You know, I use this example because one of my former competitors, a guy named Mitch Waite, started a, after he sold his computer book publishing company, back in the, oh, I don't know, it must have been in the early 90s, he started a website that was really a birding guide, you know, Bird Explorer. I forget what it's called. WhatBird is the site, whatbird.com. But then he went with the iPhone. He launched a fabulous birding guide called Bird Explorer Pro. And it completely revolutionizes how, you know, what used to be a category of book, i.e., you know, birding guides, works online. And the iPhone, you know, the phone is just a fabulous vehicle for delivering that content.
Yeah, I saw
you
that.
You can do things like listen to that bird song and identify it.
Right, I saw that app, and I thought, you have just changed the world. I used to do field biology, and you think about the amount of information you'd have to store in your head in order to be able to identify plants, trees, birds, anything out in the wild. Carry the iPhone with an app like that, it just changes your world.
Exactly. So there's categories like that, and someone from outside your field is going to come in and, you know, say, reinvent the travel guide, reinvent the, you know, the, some kind of sports category, reinvent the novel for that matter. And, I think if you're a big guy, maybe you can wait and then, you know, acquire some of the small guys. But if you're a small publisher yourself, you should be out on the front lines. And again, that's why, you know, we launched a conference called Tools of Change for Publishing, which we hold in New York in February, because it's really focused on helping people to learn from the people who are on the front lines and get with the program.
You know, there's a funny thing about, I was thinking about the conference too, that, you know, there's a certain irony because in the, when you think about pricing of e and print, and you talk about, think about values and the way people think about the object, there's a sort of implication that a physical object has a higher value than an e object because of its physical meaning in space. And I was thinking about that in terms of the conference. This is not meant to challenge its value, but just to sort of say that it's interesting that, in fact, a physical conference can bear a much higher price and has a higher perceived value for people because of the contact that you can have by meeting people in the room and as a kind of things that happen in person that cannot possibly happen online. And I think that actually is kind of useful in thinking about how we value books, and that you can have both a print book and an e-book, but they can have different values and different uses in the same way that a virtual conference and a live conference can also have continue to coexist.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. That being said, I do think that the publishing industry is at a dangerous crossroads. Because, first of all, there are only a certain number of people who read books now, and there is competition from other, whether it's sources of entertainment, sources of information. You have to realize that a book does a job for a customer. You know, it may entertain them, it may inform them, it may teach them, and there may be a better way to do that job.
Well, and, as you described with the birding guide.
That's right. Or, you just think about something like the Atlas, which was a class of book that, has pretty much gone away, or the encyclopedia, because the job is literally done much more effectively online. And I think that, so that's one problem, for publishers, that they really are competing not just with a new format, and they shouldn't think too narrowly about e-books, i.e. let's just put our books into some electronic format, but what job are you doing? So for example, with Safari, we said, wow, we're doing sort of online lookup and reference, and having a subscription service makes sense because you can now search 10,000 books instead of one book. In the case of, say, fiction, science fiction. I would bet that one of the reasons why science fiction and fantasy are down as categories is they're experiencing competition from gaming.
Yeah, I think that's true.
And gaming does the same job, but in some ways more effectively. Now, and so anyway, kind of going back to the other challenge to publishing is the retail ecosystem. I think there's a delicate balance that I don't think anyone understands in terms of the relationship between physical distribution and online distribution. Amazon is not a great place for browsing. I mean, they've added a lot of features, to try to encourage people to find more books, but I would lay odds that, and again, Amazon doesn't, reveal any statistics on this, but just based on my own purchase behavior, I hear about a book somewhere and I go search for it on Amazon and bang, I buy it. And there isn't that experience of walking into the bookstore, looking around, finding something that you'd never heard of, that you weren't looking for, that just jumped out at you.
Right, that's true.
And when bookstores go away, I think a lot of people now, they browse in bookstores and then buy online.
Right, which is kind of the death knell formula for any online or any bricks and mortar store.
Right, and it was actually an article in the New York Times today. Mobile phones become essential tools for holiday shopping. And with it's basically a description of all these short-sighted people using their phone apps to scan for better prices. They find something's, $50 in the store, and it's $30 online. They buy it. Yeah, how long is that store going to be there? And of course, they don't realize that what they're paying for when they walk into a store is the physical display of goods.
That's right. Well, just
and
talk to
when
any
the physical
talk to
display
it.
Goes away, will those goods be found? And so there's some, again, there are certainly new ways for things to be found online. Whether it's social reading sites like Goodreads and Library Thing, which I think are sort of fabulous ways. All the blogs that review books, all the mentions that happen in online media. But, it's not clear yet that those things will sustain the book industry as it currently is constituted. And again, that, one of the things that has funded, publishing has been the retail infrastructure, where you could go out there and you say, okay, to a Barnes & Noble and a Borders and the big independents and so on, how many copies will you take? And so you know how many to print. You might get returns, but everybody, works to minimize that, and you kind of have a sense of what the demand is. Now you don't. Now, if you're smart, of course, that means as a publisher, you need to be moving towards a print-on-demand kind of supply chain, because you don't have the committed upfront buys that used to fund your first printing.
Right.
Because, of course, when you print fewer copies, the prices go up.
Right. And the other thing is that all of that, the other thing that ability to place books in stores financed was the author advance and the author.
That's right. That's right. And so the point is that there's some tipping points here that, may create some unhappy surprises in the industry.
Oh, I think that seems likely. I mean, I think that when you talk about the retail ecosystem, the other thing that comes to mind that I think people, I mean, certainly publishers are aware of, when you talked about a healthy retail environment, which I think is not there today in terms of bricks and mortar, the number of stores that would take the books that you were talking about was fairly substantial. And the number of books that would essentially be loaned into the supply chain for people to look at was
That's very high.
Kind of viewpoints were what you were paying for there.
Right.
And that I think is very different. And certainly anybody who has browsed a bookstore knows that you can't browse. There is no functional browsing online that's equivalent to what you can do in a store.
Right, and this kind of takes me back in the direction of if you are a small to medium-sized publisher, there's a great deal of urgency about exploring new ways of engaging with customers online. And it may mean, the iTunes App Store may be the, one of the next big retailers for you. It is for us. We find, as we build our sort of ebook business, there is a virtual storefront. We have, I don't know what the total count is now, must be 700 or 800 books in the iTunes App Store as applications, and it's become a very meaningful revenue source for us.
I guess this is probably the last thing I can ask you. Does that mean that a publisher has to learn a new set of imperatives for how it does business?
Oh, absolutely. But this is always true in business. If you aren't adapting, you're probably dying.
Well, I think that feeling has begun to be fairly common in the book business if it wasn't there before. There's certainly a sense of the portentousness of the moment.
Yeah.
And I think now is a time for a lot of publishers to really look closely at what their business models are.
Yeah.
Well, you've been terrific to talk to. I hope we can do this again because I think you have a lot more to say. This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and this has been Tim O'Reilly from O'Reilly Media. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.